The Engineering Commons is a podcast dedicated to the challenges that engineers encounter, regardless of which industry or field they work in on a regular basis. These can be overarching topics that affect us over our entire careers, or stories of everyday frustrations and how to deal with them.
This is the episode for October 14th, 2011, and it's about superstars.
So, Jeff, when you find yourself wanting to move up in an organization, like an engineering organization, how do you go about doing that kind of thing?
Well, I don't know if I'm the best person to ask about that.
Oh, no? Why not?
No. Well, I worked at a number of companies. I worked for, big Fortune 500 companies, and I worked for small little machine shops, and I even went out on my own for a while, and I was happiest going out on my own. I really struggled within the bigger organizations figuring out what the purpose and the direction and what it was that people wanted as you started to try to move ahead. And I struggled with that. I wasn't particularly good at playing the political game. And so I was always curious. I mean, even to this day, I'm curious as to the mindset that one takes and what one thinks about and what one concentrates on and how one becomes successful in bigger organizations. But quite honestly, I wasn't particularly good at it.
Hmm. Well, don't look at me either. I get to ask the question this week, and that was for a reason. I'm clueless too. And I guess it's kind of an interesting question because in this day and age, I mean, maybe that was maybe 20 years ago, right? Maybe that was a big question, but these days people don't stick around in organizations long enough to even move up as much as they used to. Now it's kind of lateral moves to other companies and, you know, just job changes, life changes, career changes, you know, moving out of engineering entirely even sometimes. Right. So that is kind of that's a real thing. So, I don't, maybe that was your experience too, just with the moving between companies.
Yeah. And I think that, for some people, it comes pretty easy. I mean, I saw people that with a variety of engineering talents. I mean, from those who were kind of clueless about engineering but knew how to work the political levers to those who were very good at engineering and were also adept at making political moves and making the necessary connections and networking and doing all the things they needed to do to move up in an organization. But I think it varied from person to person. Either it came naturally to you or it didn't. Mm-hmm. And I didn't, quite honestly, I didn't know that many people who really studied it or struggled with it or you know, it was kind of like, well, either you had it or you didn't, or you were an engineer or you were a political climber.
Right. And so you never saw pure engineers up at the top, huh? It was more of a, you saw savvy business people up at the top or...
Right. Well, it's understandable if you're going to run an organization, especially in the past. I mean, the purpose of the sort of control structure, they talk about the command and control structure, is to get the communicate the purpose and the intent and the ideals of the organization down the line, and so you had to be a good communicator and you had to be a good networker to get people inspired and to know what they needed to make sure that their objectives were being met. I mean, you had to have those talents if you're going to run an organization that was bigger than, you know, five or six people.
Hmm. That's interesting from a measure of success as well. There's actually a recent episode of This American Life about education and actually teaching those talents, because unlike IQ and you know, just straight math and reading skills and developmental, you know, brain activity, the activities of how to connect people and how to network and all those other things, those, they say that those can be taught and that those are things that people, that's an indicator of success. There was an economics person, I can link that in the show notes, but it's interesting to hear that too, because maybe I don't think that it's one or the other. I think someone could have both, but it's interesting from the perspective of, you know, that those other softer skills are the things that can propel you forward still in the absence of, you know, straight engineering prowess.
Right. And we talked a little bit about it last episode. We were talking about networking. somebody comes and tells you that, okay, here is a skill you need to advance.
Right.
And if you're built around, you know, your life is focused on doing the engineering thing and crunching the numbers and making things happen, you look up and you go, no, I don't want to be doing that. You can tell me that that's the route to success, but I don't want to do that.
Right.
Do not make me go, you know, slap each other on the back and shake hands and talk sports if I don't want to talk sports, or talk politics if I don't want. Just leave me out of that. All I want to do is sit here and design things and build things and make things. That's what I enjoy doing. And there's nothing wrong with that, but you're unlikely to climb up in a larger organization if you don't have that networking skill.
Right. And it's interesting too, because, you know, looking at traditional corporate structures, I've always seen, you know, a lot of the bigger companies, I think, have made efforts recently, or maybe not even recently, but they make efforts to define a technical path that's, you know, actually is a technical path moving up. I mean, there is more of a managerial and oversight and architectural view from, you know, you move from, you know, technician to engineer to senior engineer to, junior architect, senior architect, that kind of thing. And then eventually you might be the VP of engineering or something like that. But that is, or not even VP of engineering, but a staff scientist, or basically the guy that's defining technologies at that point. And that is supposed to be this pathway of technical advancement. But then, you know, the more traditional thing that I think of with advancement is, you know, oh, well, you know, you're an engineer for a while, and then, well, now you're in charge, so you're a manager, and then there's a whole other path you can move on, and you have to go from being an engineer to being the manager or the business person, and the skill sets change, and the pay grade changes a little,
right,
or a lot, you know, and it's interesting to see from a corporate perspective, seeing how that is defined, and then like we were talking about just earlier, is, you know, the what it takes to actually make that jump and then move up from there.
Yeah, the skills as you move up through your organization are definitely different. Somebody at the top may be good technically, but it's more important that they're good socially. They've got to talk to buyers, and people buy to a certain extent based on technical parameters, features of the device or service. But a lot of it is whether I like you or not, whether you make me feel good. You can go buy coffee cheaper than at Starbucks, but people go to Starbucks because they like being there. It gives them a good feeling being in a place that has cool music and, you know, makes you order with Italian sounding words. There's a certain coolness. Well, I mean, those aren't Italian words. Those are, you know, made up words in some sense that sound Italian. I think that's right.
I thought they were real Italian words.
Oh, maybe they are.
But that's neither here nor there.
But yeah. but they make if it's a real Italian, they make you speak the real Italian to get, you know, the size. You used to be able to say, I want a large coffee.
Oh, I still say that. You can't say that anymore? I'm pretty sure you could still say that.
Oh, okay.
If you ignore people long enough, they'll just give you a coffee.
It's not good enough to say... A grande, or what's the next one up? Is it a venti?
Yeah, I'm not sure.
I don't know.
I haven't
pay
that
been
much
to Starbucks
coffee.
Often enough.
Right. Yeah. still a grad student, huh, Jeff?
Right. We buy a lot on emotion, how it makes us feel, how this, you know, it's the hope, the lottery ticket. You don't buy it based on the thought that you really think you're going to win the lottery.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we
you're saying that there's a human component to all of this, right?
Yeah, it's the joy of you having bought, and there's a period of time between you have the ticket in your hand and the drawing occurs, and you win or lose, or you get the scratch off ticket and you have it in your hand and you scratch it off, and somewhere in there, there's a great feeling of just the hope, the dream that something good might happen here, and people are willing to pay for that,
right? And in the same way of, you know, people wanting that comfort, they want that familiarity, those kind of things, they really, when it comes down to it, I mean, it's human emotion manifesting itself in business, right? I mean, that's a lot of it, right? When you know, you go to the same salesperson each time because you have a relationship with them. That's human emotion. You want to maintain that connection. You know, that they're, all of these things end up playing into business interactions, and that's kind of the other side of it.
So it makes it kind of gives me a chuckle when I talk to my friends who are in the big organizations, and they talk about, well, what they have to do to move up, and even though the networking and social skills can be taught, it's never the networking or social skills that they have to do to move up. It's usually something like, well, they have to complete a certain number of Six Sigma projects.
Really?
and so, you know, when they talk about, okay, you start, you know, your green belt and you do enough of these, you become a black belt, and, you know, they're, which,
so
it's
very well defined, huh?
It's well defined, you know, you have to do these projects, which is all well and good, but I wonder if that's really what you need to move to do well in the organization. Hmm. And maybe it is because they need that to be part of the organization's culture.
Mm-hmm.
But
I think it's more of the case when it's not a defined path, right? It's when you have, you know, other people moving within an organization, you know, a VP moves to a president and then you need to fill in the VP slot, and then, you know, and everybody kind of shuffles around, and it's when you have these decisions to make, and this happens on engineering levels too, right? You know, it could be, well, we're allowed to promote one engineer to senior engineer this year, and there's five choices, and you know, some of it will be subjective, right? You can never make a completely objective choice on a hiring or promotion decision. So all of these things, you know, it, in terms of moving up, there's always a human subjective component to it, and that's kind of the part that makes us uncomfortable, right? I mean, that's as an engineer, I don't like that. I don't like the, I want it to be a meritocracy. I want it to be, you know, I want it to be even money-based. You know, I did project A that earned the company $100,000, and, you know, Jeff did project B that earned them $200,000, so Jeff is the obvious choice of, you know, but there are no obvious choices, right? It could be that, you know, I've known the manager longer, and to just ignore it, to just say, oh, well, that's not right, and that sucks, and everything else, to just ignore it is at your own peril, really. I mean, I think that's kind of the idea behind, that's the idea I take away from it. And if it is something you care about, and it is something that you want, then, yeah, you might have to pay attention to that kind of stuff. I'm not saying it's, you know, ethical or right, or saying it's unethical. I'm just saying that I'm not making any judgment on it, just that this occurs. That's my main point with it.
It's the way the world is. And so... We can't ignore friction. We can't ignore electrical noise. Things rust. Things sag.
Right.
Things break.
So it is a design constraint. You're saying it's an economic and job design constraint.
Sure, it's something that if you want to move up in an organization, you better be aware of that. People are going to be judging you as much on how you appear and how you make them feel as what you're able to do for them.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
It's kind of scary, but it's the truth.
It is. And again, we kind of got into these kind of discussions too when we were talking ethics, the ethics episode we had of, you know, it's not necessarily right or wrong. It's just what it is, right? I mean, some people will look at, you know, someone that's doing these things we're going to talk about, and they'll say, well, I think that's wrong, or I think, you know, I should only have to do engineering. And it's like, yep, you are correct, but that is a choice, and based on the constraints of the system, that the outcome means that you might not move up in a corporate system. Now, there's a lot of other options, right? I mean, Jeff, like you said, you started consulting and you enjoyed that, and I think that's a good path for, you know, kind of escaping the moving up aspect of large corporations. And you know, I've had friends do that as well, and you get more freedom that way.
In a certain, I want to say happiness. In fact, I was just reading an article somewhere today. It may have been Harvard Business Review, but they were talking about how managers at the top have less stress than people further down. And so people think about, well, you must have lots of stress because you're at the top of the organization and have to worry about managing everybody. Mm. And at least this article was saying not the case. Even those that didn't take care of themselves, they got less sleep and ate worse, still showed less signs of stress than those who were several levels down in the organization and didn't have that autonomy that
Daniel, the ability to steer one's own fate is one of the defining factors in stress, huh?
Exactly.
Yeah.
In fact, I'm still finishing up the Free Agent Nation book, and they talk in there about a lot of people leaving big organizations for exactly that reason, right. Just because they felt happier once they had a little more autonomy over what they were doing.
Right. And this is the same kind of case, right? It's not necessarily that, you know, I did A, it outcome was B, and I should be rewarded with C. That's not always the case. And as an individual employee from a larger company perspective, you know, you're not going to have that kind of control. So that's the reason to, in this case, it's I did A, you know, the outcome was B. I happened to also be doing Z at the time, so, you know, now I have a different outcome from all of that. So it's
right.
Interesting set of inputs.
And that was part of what just drove me nuts at big companies was, and it may have changed. I mean, I left, last time I worked for a big organization was 1992-ish. So it's been 20 years.
Right.
And so things may have changed, but at that time, my experience was that decisions were made on high and weren't, and there wasn't a whole lot of information given about why those decisions were made. And so you were told, you know, on one day that job A was the most important and make it happen and nothing should get in the way of job A. And then suddenly 2 weeks later or 2 months later, whatever it was, they'd come in and go, drop A. That's not important anymore. Let's do B.
Right.
And,
right.
And that would just drive me nuts.
Yeah. Yeah. And even as a consultant, you have to do that sometimes. But in that case, you know, you can at least either make that decision of, well, I'm not going to, you know, even though I have to move to job B, I'm either going to ignore it or, you know, take the consequences. Or, you know, you justify it away. And it's easy to, I mean, say, well, I can like this and this about job B. So, yeah, it's
right.
Yeah,
well, you have some control over those you work with. I mean, you normally go meet them in advance at the beginning of the job, and you get some sense of what they're about and
right.
whether you feel like you're going to get along well or not. So you've got a little heads up on it.
Right.
And as you go through the job, as I one of the first episodes we did, I talked about how I normally would split these jobs up into smaller contracts so that we'd spend, you know, 2 or 3 weeks brainstorming and coming up with ideas, and then would sit down and draw up what the next part of the contract would be. And so at those steps, you always had the option of saying, sorry, I've had enough. This isn't going in a direction that I'm happy with.
Right. Right. Yeah.
I don't know as I ever did that. I can't think of any one. Well, I take it back. I had one job where I went in and made the presentation, and the guy was just trying to think of any better word, but he was an asshole. That was the best word that describes him. And I had no desire to work with this guy and his organization, just
right.
none.
Right.
And so even though they came back and said, hey, we were interested, we want to do it, I said, I'm sorry, guys, but, you know, I'll give you everything. You know, we did the upfront brainstorming. I'll give you all the CAD drawings and all the calculations. Those are yours, but I'm out. I have no desire to work further.
Yeah, there's this really great, I mean, since we're on the topic of your consulting, is there's this really great article on consulting that I might have referenced on this show before. And it says, he actually refers to another article, but they ask, how do you know that you've made it as a consultant, basically? And mm-hmm. the answer was always, you know, when I don't have to do business with people I don't like. And right. I always like that. And just like when you get to turn people down, right? You're doing okay,
right?
But you don't have that in a corporate environment. It's you can't just say, well, you know, well, you can. Everybody always has that choice. You can't say, well, I'm not going to do what you want, you know, Mr. President or CEO. you have that choice, but you know, you might be shown the door. So
right. So I guess that's always the option, is that you can be shown the door, but that comes with a heavy emotional cost, you know, especially if you have family, you know, how are you going to provide for them? What,
right.
what does it have to do with your health insurance, health coverage? What are you going to do for money? What are you going to do for, there's whole bunches of things. And so it's hard to make that. Plus, none of us like change. So,
right.
well, most of us don't like change. So
Well, the ones who are unprepared don't like change, or not used to change don't like change, I think. I think once you get in the use, the you know, you get used to change, you accept it a little better, I think.
Right.
Maybe I'm wrong.
Right.
I don't know.
But I have been in positions, jobs where I knew that it just, you know, it wasn't going well. And I kept trying, you know, well, I'll just hang on for another day. I'll hang on for another week. I'll hang on for another month.
Yep.
Hoping that, you know, that something would change and it would get better, or that, but it never does. At least it never did for me.
Yeah. No, I know what you mean. So we should get on to the, what prompted all this, really. I mean, we should, I mean, we talked about free agency last week. What's that?
We have a reason for all this?
Oh, we do. Yeah, we do. I had emailed Jeff about this article I found in the comments section of a website, and it's interesting. But it was an article called How to Be a Star Engineer, and it was written by Robert E. Kelly, and he was part of Carnegie Mellon in the business school. And we were trying to kind of figure this out because it's actually quite old, not quite old. It's been around for a while. It was published in October of 1999. So it puts it at, what, 13 years now.
Right.
And it's also a book. And we should say that as well. It's actually Robert Kelly ended up turning it into a book, a more generalized case of How to Be a Star at Work, 9 Breakthrough Strategies You Need to Succeed. And so what we were thinking is this might have been the, you know, 1999 equivalent of writing a guest or blog post or guest post like on a blog, right. But you know, back when there weren't blogs, so you know, a promotional like article basically, and so we were kind of going through this and some of the stuff really doesn't apply these days, and some of it really still does, and some of it only applies if you're in a corporate environment and everything like that. But we thought it was really interesting from a, you know, an engineering perspective of, I'm an engineer right now. Maybe I want to move up in the coming years. What do I need to do in order to do that? So we thought we'd go over some of the things that he talks about in this article and his book.
Right. And being the highly prepared and diligent people that we are, as opposed to trying to integrate his thoughts into separate categories and into our own innovative structure, I think we're just going to work from the structure he laid out in his article, which happens to be the same structure he has in his book.
Right,
and we'll just go from there.
Why you wouldn't draw a mustache on the Mona Lisa, right?
No.
And we should mention, I mean, this is a very highly reviewed book on Amazon as well, 4.5 stars. A lot of people that really like it. So you know. It is an interesting. We haven't read the book, but we have read this article, and it's quite interesting. So, should we just dive right in?
Let's do that.
Okay, so there's 9 work strategies that he talks about, and in talking about some of these, I mean, some of them are kind of generic, right? But you know, we're gonna go through them. We'll make some comments on each of them, and really just how they play out in an engineering role, especially in, you know, big company, small company, that kind of thing. So and how maybe, you know, it's gone on in our own lives as well. So
okay, so let me, before we get to number one here, let me just I'm gonna quote just a little line here from the middle of this article. And he says, star performers, and he sort of, you know, this whole thing is, are how are you going to be a star performer? And they have a bit here where he talks about what must you do to dazzle everyone?
Right.
I'm a little worried about dazzling, but okay.
Right. Jazz fingers.
Yeah, right. Star performers, in fact, do their work quite differently from the pack. Okay, so you're going to be, if you got to follow this, I guess you're going to be different. They weave their starring strategies into a consistent pattern of day-to-day behavior. So not just something you can do once. You have to do it all the time, but they, you know, here's the sort of the tease, but any engineer with the necessary smarts and motivation can acquire their power.
Ultimate power.
So what is necessary smarts? Is that like any smarts, or, and what is necessary motivation? Is that the will to,
I think, you know, wanting to get a different job. Okay. I want the senior position of what I'm in now.
All right.
I want that 5% raise. So I mean, maybe, I'm not sure.
He continues to say, no magic pill or silver bullet will blast you to the top. Instead, stellar performance is based on a set of 9 interlocking, not just separate, interlocking work strategies.
Right.
Ooh, I didn't see this before. They are ranked in order of importance. So This is 1 to 9 is not just 1 to 9. It's 1 to 9 in order of importance.
So does that mean 9 is the most important?
Oh, he didn't say, did he?
No, he didn't.
So we don't know.
Oh, well, we'll call him afterwards.
All right.
All right, let's jump in, though. Okay, so number one is blazing trails. And I think we should really frame all this stuff in the, from an engineer's point of view. And so I guess the first question here is it possible for an engineer to blaze trails? Because sometimes that's not what an engineer is there for. I think sometimes the engineer is there for following closely and, figuring out where the path is and then following it. I think some of that is. Maybe I'm wrong.
Well, sometimes we talked about it on the ethics show. Sometimes the engineer has to be the adult in the room.
Right.
And it's real easy for, you're sitting around a conference table and somebody draws up something on the board and somebody else says, oh, that's neat. Well, if we just did this and that, we'd have a killer project and super sales. And somebody else goes, oh yeah. And if we did that, and at some point somebody sometimes has to sit there and go, that's all well and good. Nice idea. But you can't have a perpetual motion machine.
Right.
And the laws
exactly.
of physics do not permit you to do this.
Right. We're supposed to be in production in 6 months, and that wants to be that looks like a 18-month project right there, just based on sourcing components and, inventing new technologies.
Right.
Yeah.
So that is usually not the organization sometimes needs that, but that's usually not how you move up in the organization.
Right. Right, exactly. And that's an interesting point too, right? I mean, maybe our listeners don't have the context of this, but there is a concept called failing upwards. And I'm not sure if you've heard of that before, Jeff, but
I've heard of the Peter principle though.
Oh, what's that?
The Peter principle was that everyone rises to the level of their incompetency within an organization.
Right, that's the exact same idea is if you can't say you've got 4 electrical engineers in a room and one of them cannot do the circuit design that needs to be done, well, guess that guy's in charge of project management now.
Right.
Or guess that guy's in charge of budgets now. And when it comes time, you might come down that the guy that's in charge of budget or the guy that's in charge of schedule, he might be looked upon more favorably by other people doing budgets and finance, and those people might happen to be in charge. So
right, because the VP of engineering has been seeing the budget guy in all his meetings and gets to know him, and hey, they can talk a little football, and he seems like a nice guy. So when it's time to give him a managerial position, he's going to be the one that gets it.
That's right. That's right. So blazing trails as an engineer, maybe you can do that. I mean, there's something to be said for stepping out of line when, we've all heard of skunk work projects, right? That would be my equivalent of blazing trails, but you're not really blazing a trail. You're more of sneaking off the trail and you're making a little fire in the woods, and then that turns into a blaze, right? It's not,
right.
It's not necessarily, right. Running down the trail with a new torch, right?
Right. Well, I think the idea of initiative is to not so much go out and look for something that takes you away from the group, but to take initiative that brings benefit to the group. So if there's somebody that, someone has to stay late and, crank the numbers for the Monday meeting, you volunteer to do that. If someone needs to sort out the inventory to make sure you're prepared for next week's job, you offer to do that.
That's true. So, that is some of the examples he shows here. I was kind of hung up on the blazing trails. I don't think those things really match up, to be honest. The guy that says, I'm going to work the hardest on the spreadsheet that, the boss told us to work on.
Right.
That's not what I think of when I think of blazing trails. So I was a little hung up on the title.
I see the disconnect there. Blazing Trail sounds a little more adventuresome than sitting around on Friday night and counting inventory.
Right, right. Yeah, and one of the quotes here, too, is, star performers in our studies were adamant that while they were always looking for roof-raising initiatives, the small day-to-day efforts had the same impact over time. So again, Blazing Trails, maybe not so much, but in this case, just kind of keeping at it would be the effort. Effort would be the case here. You know, put in effort, you will succeed. So,
right. Well, and I think, as with any job, you're going to do better if you pitch in when the group needs help, as opposed to saying my watch says it's 5 o'clock. I'm out of here.
I got some beers waiting for me at home, so I'm gonna skedaddle.
I will see you Monday precisely at 8 o'clock.
That's right.
Not a minute before.
That's right. And don't forget those donuts, Bob. You owe us. All right. So number two is knowing who knows.
Sort of back to the networking thing.
Yes. And they're saying it's beyond just networking, though. And I think it's getting to the key person of influence in a group, right? And knowing how to develop that, not within your own group just, but also external to the group.
So what they mean is sucking up?
No, I don't think so, though. I think it's I think of it in a manufacturing. So I was thinking about it today, and I've always worked in manufacturing alongside engineering. And when you have two organizations like that, you know, in manufacturing in general, getting stuff done can be painful sometimes, especially when there exists a disconnect between engineering and manufacturing. Mm-hmm. However, any engineer worth his salt knows the technician who knows how to fix stuff the best. They know the production manager, who's the one who is blazing trails, as the author defines it, of staying late and getting stuff done. And they know the key people to get to in order to get stuff done, really. And so I think that's really what the author is getting at here. And
so they're aware of the unofficial organizational chart?
That's right. And I think that is actually a very valuable thing. You know, you can have, you know, like the failing upwards thing we talked about earlier is, you know, you can have people at various, you know, levels in the organization, but if you know that the VP always gets overridden by the other VP, then, you know, you don't necessarily jump over to that other VP, but maybe you present ideas to both of them, and you know, you make sure that everybody knows what you're thinking, so that, you know, maybe that overriding can happen if it needs to, that kind of thing. So right. I, in this case, I can really get behind this one.
Yeah, I'm just trying to think. So for somebody to whom it comes naturally, just walking up to people and having conversation, this is easy. You know, you just, as you run into people, you have conversation, you learn what they do, you ask the questions. What I'm thinking about is for the individual who it's difficult, they're not naturally outgoing or strike up conversations. Right. How do you teach them to do this? And I guess what I'd say is start small. You know, don't, you know, feel like you have to walk up to the highest person in the organization and strike up a conversation. Go to some other person that's, you know, maybe lateral to you or a level up, and just, hi, how you doing? Strike up a conversation. Try small, but just if it's uncomfortable for you, do something small, right? And it gets better. It's not forever horrible.
Right. Well, you know, I've always found that two things in both networking and in this case, I mean, this would be like the way I define it was kind of internal networking, right? Within a company, especially when it's a bigger company. But the two things that I've always found that are really helpful in networking are, mm-hmm, one, curiosity. So, you know, asking that person what they're working on and, you know, asking for their help because you think they're, I mean, hopefully if they are indeed an expert. And then also, you know, providing value back to that person of, okay, well, thank you so much for, you know, showing me how this process worked. You know, can I work with you on your next project to, you know, get that kind of thing done? That would be on an internal kind of thing, but showing that value or, you know, ushering other people their way because you know they are an expert, mm-hmm, that would be kind of feeding their ego a little bit. But I think that is a key point of any networking is, one, curiosity, and that's probably the biggest one, and two, providing value back to that person because they, you know, because they helped you out, because you want to continue this relationship with them. And in the case of, you know, the manufacturing, you know, engineer who knows how to get stuff through your manufacturing floor quickly, you know, you're going to provide value to them by letting them know when design changes are coming that might affect them, or, you know, staying late and helping with something on the floor, that kind of thing. That is how you provide, how I would provide value back to them. And that allows you to build relationships too and everything else. So that would be internal networking, I think.
Right. And the author goes on to talk about a little bit about that. One of the advantages of having these network connections is it allows you to avoid getting stuck. That
right.
you come to a point where you're just not making any progress and you need help, but you don't know who to go talk to. If you have the network, you can do that.
Right, exactly. And just like in external networking, right? You don't network when you're looking for a job. You're supposed to be networking when you're, when you're, you know, you're just every day, right? I mean, you're supposed to be trying to meet new people in your field, because when you get laid off with, you know, a moment's notice, the people who are best networked are the ones who already have people that they go, you know, tell their story to, and then they're offered three jobs in the same day. Those are the stories that you hear about. So,
right.
Yeah, I agree with this point. I think this is a really key one in any organization, and not just for moving up. I think it's just for getting stuff done, and that's why it's really valuable. I found that especially in the design versus manufacturing field. I mean, bridging that gap has never been easy, and this is something I've had to learn over time. Some of my friends were really, really good at it, and I had to learn from them, actually. So
yeah. Well, I wonder, since this article is titled "How to Be a Star Engineer," whether a star engineer isn't the bit about not getting stuck is more important than the bit about networking. I mean, the networking is important, but if you want to be seen as a star engineer, you don't at any one point in your career want to be seen as someone who got really stuck and bogged down and couldn't do it.
Right.
Because while everybody likes to watch the dramas on, you know, Saturday night about the movie about the kid that, you know, came up against the roadblock and found, you know, struggled
adversity.
Through and found a way, adversity found a way through it, you know, a real tearjerker.
Right.
That's great on TV, but in a career.
Right. Now when it's hitting the bottom line, yeah.
Because you'll always be known as, oh, he was the guy that, you know, hit the wall on that project and
never recovered.
Never recovered or spent months recovering. Or
what are you doing, Rocky?
We spent $500,000 or $1 million or $10 million or whatever it is getting around out of that hole that he dug us. And,
I agree.
So if you see, the advice is, if you see yourself getting stuck, or you're looking out and you think you might be getting stuck, that's the time to start asking for help. And even if you don't have these network connections, who are, you know, your boss, your coworkers, whoever you got, start reaching out ahead of time. Don't let yourself get plowed so far under that there's no escape.
Right, right. And keeping that, I mean, since you were talking about the perception of you as an engineer, that brings us to our next point of proactive self-management.
Ooh.
And so one would be, you know, how you're viewed as a, you know, as an engineer, and, you know, how people are feel confident, you know, giving work to you and responsibility if you are looking to move up.
Right.
But that's all kind of based around the fact that you are self-actualized and you know what your strengths are, what your weaknesses are, and you're working towards improving them. Right. So one of the examples the author says is time management, right? That's a big one. And I know that's personally one of my weaknesses. You know, I can lose myself in a data sheet search when I should have just, you know, gone with the first one that I picked instead of reading 20 of them, right? And you know, there's an economic value to going with the first one, even if it's, you know, trying out a part and figuring it out and then going back instead of just doing all the research up front. You know, there is value in recognizing the value of your time and the company's time. And when you have that skill set, it makes you more valuable to your organization.
But it sort of has to do with also what it is you're trying to, I'm going back to time management, what you're trying to get out of it. So again, from the organization standpoint, you quickly, deciding what you need to do and going, hey, I'm stuck, or I've got to spend less time on this, and so I should outsource it. Like I remember in a prior episode, you were talking, Chris, about enjoying doing solid modeling, but you were advised to let go of it, you know, outsource it.
Right.
So,
and I did. I did.
So from the organizational standpoint, that's a good thing. From your standpoint, you're never going to get any better at it unless you keep working
right.
at it. So,
right.
so there's that trade-off when we talk about being a star engineer. Are you being a star engineer from the sense of the company, what they think is star engineer material, or what you think is star engineer material?
Right.
And the two aren't necessarily the same.
That's right, exactly. And and in this same number three here, he talks about one thing might be that you're not allowed to work on it on your regular time, and so you got to do it outside of work. And that's one thing that I've always pushed is working on hobby projects, working on personal development outside of work. Yeah, it stinks that you don't get to watch that TV show or go out to the bar with your buddies, but on the same token, if you are looking to advance, you do have to put in the hours to develop yourself and develop your skills more, and it might not always be technical skills. I mean, it could be lateral skills like I was doing 3D CAD, but it might be, learning how to, you might go to a Toastmaster session and become a better speaker, something like that. And
right.
and there are other skill sets that you might need to develop outside of work. And no one's going to tell you to do that. They're not going to be like, well, you need to get your corporate speech making credits this year. So be sure to go to that Toastmasters class.
Right.
If they are, you probably wouldn't like that in the first place. So
right.
considering, public speaking is what the number one fear of most people. Is that right?
Yeah, that and that, or a close nearby spiders, right?
See, luckily I do both. I've realized my fear of killing spiders while in my basement and somewhat speaking publicly. Luckily I'm just talking into a microphone, but
right.
All right. So number four, it would be getting the big picture. Did you see this a lot in your work? I mean,
the problem is, I think, not so much that people can't see, as the communication is often not delivered. So you'll work on a machine, you work on a project, you work on a project, and you're told just enough to get the job done. This machine must be these dimensions, or this project will be, to do this, or this product is going to be positioned such. But rarely is the whole, where does this fit in the big scheme of things, and why is it important to this organization? A lot of times that doesn't happen.
Right, and sometimes for strategic reasons, right? So in the case of a contractor like you were sometimes, or a consultant, sometimes they leave that stuff out because of proprietary secrets. Sometimes people leave that information out because they think they're protecting their own job. And so, yeah, I would agree that sometimes this isn't possible, right? From a, it's a very admirable thing to have, but sometimes in engineering, you're just not allowed to, you're not allowed there. They want, you were hired for this job and you better do this job and just do it and get it done. And sometimes that doesn't allow for bigger picture.
Right.
Well, that case, you need to be spoon-fed new requirements or whatever else, because that's just how the job is set up.
Right. Well, the topic, the subheading for this section is called getting the big picture, and I think getting needs to be the word that gets the most emphasis, because if you're not given enough information, then it's got to be up to you to actively go out and get the information to allow you to put context around what you're doing and that allows you to, in a lot of cases, to make a better product or process or service or whatever it is you're trying to design or work on, because you understand who's using it, why they're using it, what aspects are important. But it also steps on toes sometimes.
That's right.
If you start up into asking up the organization, well, why are we building this product instead of that product? Somebody may sit down and say, hey,
because yeah.
Yeah. So, sometimes you'll get an open answer, and sometimes you'll be told to mind your own business.
That's right. Yeah.
And so, and
I love what you said there about context. I think context is something that's missing in education. It's missing in a lot of jobs. It's missing in career development. I think that, and even in, like we were talking about playing the political games, right? That's a lot of that is context. You might see a manager making a decision And you say, well, why are they doing that? And well, you don't have the context of, well, that they're, you know, listening to the finance guy and the marketing guy and everybody else. And they actually are making a rather informed decision, but because they have that context and you don't, right? And so there, that exists in a lot of, especially in large organizations of, you know, you don't always have that context. Right. But I really like the idea of, you know, like I mentioned with Skunkworks, I mean, when you can, and when you do develop those relationships across, you know, if you have an applications group at your company, right, and you go slip them a picture of your latest product and you think, you say, hey, what do you think of that? Right. And they say, you know, they give you that feedback. You know, that's a big part of product development is feedback and being able to, you know, change things before it gets too expensive. And in big organizations, sometimes you have to base it on relationships versus basing it on these, you know, big reviews and processes and when other aspects get involved. So I like this one too. This one passes the Chris test.
So the next one is the right kind of followership.
See, now this makes me feel like this was actually written not 13 years ago, but 13 weeks ago, maybe on like Twitter or something like that. Right kind of followership, which we should also mention that the Engineering Commons does have a Twitter feed, if anyone's interested. It's at TEC_podcast. Ooh. How'd you like that one, Jeff? It was pretty good.
You snuck that in. That was good.
Right in there. Yeah, exactly. Context.
No one saw him coming.
Exactly. But I think this is the same kind of thing. If, you know, Twitter is about people, you know, following your everyday musings, right?
Right.
And this idea is having people that are keeping an eye on your career, really. So this might be, you know, you not necessarily like actively networked, but you know, you've got to know a product manager, and you know, and they kept an eye on the work you're doing, and oh well, Jeff always has these great ideas, and I'm going to keep an eye on him. And then when they see that there's a product coming up that they want someone to work on, well, they say, oh well, I know Jeff's good because I've been watching his work, and I want him to work on this for me. And from a, you know, getting interesting work, I think this is another good one.
Okay. I kind of took it from the aspect of sort of being the right type of order taker. That the idea was that
you needed
to take what your bosses and your colleagues were saying and to be responsive to what they did, and if they ask you to do something, to do it with, you know, a smile on your face and great cheer, and to do it to the best of your ability, so that when the next process came up, you'd be remembered as the one who did, who followed the guidelines and the instructions correctly.
Hmm. Yeah, you're right, and that is a big part of this. And but then you're right. The other part of this is also, yeah, I totally glossed it. I had the wrong idea here. They are also talking about the Skunkworks idea here as well. So you follow orders, right? They say, you know, cost is the most important part of this new product.
Mm-hmm.
But the subtext might be, yeah, but if it isn't better than your customer's or your competitor's product, then, you know, no one's going to buy it in the first place, so cost doesn't matter. And so you have to understand and balance those things. So I think that's another part of this followership that they're talking about. So,
yeah,
you know, you hear and you receive the information from, you know, whoever's telling you what to do, and you process it, but then you also show a little reverence, and you also, you know, you go beyond and you deliver other stuff as well. So I was completely off with the Twitter reference. Sorry.
Well, that's quite all right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but one thought I had on this though, is that you have to be careful that when you're trying to follow orders, you have to understand that you're going to be judged by whether you deliver what they want at the time you deliver it, as opposed to maybe what they told you.
Huh. Could you explain that a little better? I don't quite understand that.
Sure. So,
maybe a context example?
I can't give exact.
This is a real thing.
But somebody could tell you that, you know, I want a more, you know, curvy looking car or something, and you deliver them a car that looks like an egg, and you say, you just can't get any curvier than this,
right?
And they go, oh no, I wanted something that looked like a, you know, a BMW. Well, okay, so maybe you didn't get the specs weren't tight enough, or maybe they didn't explain it enough. But in the end, you're going to get judged by how well you meet their ideal expectation that's in their head that maybe they did or did not do a good job of explaining to you.
Right, so the onus of responsibility is on your shoulders, right? It's
right. So as you sit and you look at the spec sheet and you work, you know, you do your engineering magic, making meeting all the specs. Every once in a while, stand back and say, okay, what is the personal perspective on this? The people who are going to judge this, what are they really looking for? Look around at what other projects they seem to reward. Look in their office. What kind of things do they have up on the walls that indicates the kinds of things they like? Is it, you know, is it big picture type stuff or is it all detail type stuff? Is it, is it abstract art or is it, you know, landscapes or just, you know, what kind of music do they like? Anything that tries to give you a sense of how are they going to emotionally react to whatever you deliver, because we all emotionally react to, you know, everything we experience. So,
right. So this is almost like a followership, but also, you know, if they're your leader, then they're also your audience. So it's like a know your audience kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
I see.
Well,
I see.
And don't you think that you know, when you talk about a good follower, it's somebody that makes their boss look good?
Yeah, that's true.
That's what the boss wants.
Right. So you might even have to look beyond what the boss likes and look to whoever's judging them and see what that person likes.
Yeah, well, that's where it starts getting tricky, because it's not just a one-to-one sale. Now you've got a complex sale where you've got to influence many people along the line.
Right. And all you want to do is just, you know, do a good CAD model and make a nice-looking product, right? Wrong.
Yeah, but
you thought customers were hard.
At least for me, the joy of making the CAD model is completely different than the putting out the product or the service. I mean, I can be very, even if the product turns out to be a failure, I can be real happy with the CAD model. What I learned, what kind of structure I put into the model, what kind of constraints I was able to enforce with the little code, all that stuff can be great, and the outcome can be bad. And that's, I think that's what this being a follower gets to, is you have to sort of sometimes subjugate your own joy and happiness to what your boss and your organization really need.
Right. But only if you want to get ahead.
Yeah. If you don't want to get ahead, then just do whatever the heck you want to.
That's right.
You may be shown the door soon, but, you know, enjoy it while you can.
But you will have some awesome CAD models.
Assuming that's what you're spending your time doing.
Right. Yes. All right. So number six, teamwork is joint ownership of a project. I'm not sure I understand what this one means. Is this idea of sharing, like, responsibility? Is that kind of the idea as you see it?
I don't understand the difference between... So let me go back. So at the beginning of this section, they say average performers think teamwork means working cooperatively with others on a project or problem and doing your part on the team. And I would say, okay, I agree with that. That would sort of be my definition.
You need to play nice in the sandbox in order to, yes.
Okay. Star producers take it to a higher level.
Ah.
Yeah, so we'll see if they see it as a complex series of skills. That to me, I read that as hand waving, you know, magic occurs. They see it as a complex series of skills that involve taking joint, quote unquote, ownership of goal setting, group commitments, work activities, schedules, and group accomplishments.
Right. Yeah, this seems kind of fluffy. I have to say, this one really does. I mean, of course you need to take ownership, but... So he's basically saying that just playing along is not enough. That you have to step out front and define goals in order to, you know, be able to meet them, in order to, you know, make yourself look good. I'm not sure that's exactly what he's saying, but I feel like this is what people do naturally. I mean, if you're not taking ownership in projects, then you're not a leader in the first place, right? I mean, that's basically what he's saying is, be a leader. You know, don't be necessarily just a follower. And you can say, be a leader. So,
right. Well, as I reread it, I'm sort of seeing it as being concerned about the structure of the project and the group, the sort of the meta information that's going on underneath it all. So instead of just worrying about, is somebody signed up to, you know, deliver a manufacturing mold by September, whatever, you're also worried about, well, do we have the right structure in place for everybody to get the information so they can do their job? And is somebody taking notes so that it can be distributed afterwards? And we, you know, is somebody getting the information to Joe who happens to be off on vacation?
Yeah, that's interesting from the other side, I guess, is maybe not, you know, joining in and taking ownership, you know, taking partial ownership of the project, but maybe making sure that everyone else takes ownership so that you actually can succeed as a team. That would actually be, I could see being a real skill, because, you know, even if you are the ad hoc leader of a team in this case, right? So I'm the circuit designer, you're the mechanical designer, and there's a manufacturing person, and there's an industrial designer there, right?
Right.
And you and I decide we're going to lead this team, but the other guys are just, you know, showing up and saying, yeah, yeah, whatever. Then it's going to be much harder in order to actually achieve a goal at the end of the day, because, well, they've got other things going on, or, you know, they've got that, you know, date at the bar with their buddies to, you know, hang out and drink beers, right? So
right.
Encouraging ownership from everyone, I could see as a much more way to stand out more, you know, so.
Right.
And that kind of leads into the next one, which is...
Well, before we go there, I don't know what the right way on a podcast is to, like, signal, you know, if I'm doing something online, I can put in brackets, like, you know, cynical comment ahead.
Okay.
Yeah, and I can bracket with... And
cynical comment ahead.
Thank you. So...
Warning. Cynical comment.
So my notion was, in watching people who moved up quickly through the organizations, was that the ones who are really good at it always worked on projects that were going well. And as soon as they were on a project that wasn't going well, they found a way to get off that project pronto and onto something else.
Interesting.
So they were never tainted by being associated with a project that went south.
Wow. That's interesting. There's a book by Seth Godin, who's a marketer. Mm-hmm. And it's called The Dip.
Yes.
And it's this really short book. And at the end of it, I actually kind of said to myself, well, what the hell did I just read? But when you read it, it just, like, kind of all falls together. But basically the idea is, you know, the best performers are what you said there. And not just in projects, but in life. You know, they try something hard for a little bit. And when it doesn't work, they bounce, right? They get out. So if I got into podcasting this week and I tried it two or three times and I hated it, then I'd get out, right? Those people know to get out. But the dip is basically, you know, you have two options. You either get out, you bail, or, you know, you fight through it. You fight through that low point, which is, you know, figuring out podcasting works and, you know, trying to find people to listen to it and everything else. And then eventually you kind of start on an upward trajectory. So I think you're talking about the people that bail early, but maybe the people over the long term would hopefully, you know, stick with it and, you know, eventually deliver.
Right. It's my impression was, in seeing those who rose quickly to the top of the organization were often those who bailed early, and you know, as the project was getting difficult and things weren't going well, they were suddenly moved off of that and onto something else. And I was always amazed at how they managed to do that.
See, now the real question with that would be, though, is, are those people actually making an impact in the organization and the world at large? Because, yeah, you can get, you know, you can get credit for stuff and move up quickly, or, you know, you can actually fight through it, you know, achieve a goal and then, you know, move on to the next thing, right? The analogy being, like, in schoolwork, you can go through class and you can just, you know, memorize the material and get an A, or you can go through, you know, learn the material, internalize the material, and then, you know, do well on the test because you actually know it. And those people are the ones that actually do well in the long term because they actually know something new, right? If you go back to the guy that just went and memorized stuff, he won't know any of that material in 2 years. And, you know, they should kind of have to keep iterating on the quick fixes. So I'm sure the same thing. I hope anti-cynicism here. I hope that is the case, and maybe you know, maybe you don't, maybe you didn't stick around long enough to see them, but I hope that
I think you'll find that in in upper management and lower management, as in all walks of life. There are some people who are extraordinarily talented and those who aren't, and some who deserve to be there and some who don't. And it's rare. I mean, if you find an organization where everybody works well together and everybody is talented, then you want to work there. You want to find out what's going on there, because that's not the normal case.
Right. Yeah. It's much more evenly distributed everywhere else. Huh?
So, something is going on there that's going on right.
Right. Yeah. If it doesn't look like a bell curve, it's probably doing something right.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we should talk about number 7.
Cool.
This one is small L leadership. And this sounds like something straight out of, if you'll excuse the phrase, the MBA playbook. Because I know that you have a copy of that on your shelf, but I don't think you refer to it that often.
So the big L leadership is the idea that, and that's sort of been popularized, especially through the 90s, that you had some charismatic person who was going to be at the top of the organization, who was going to, you know, drive the organization forward through their vision, through their willpower, through their knowledge, through their divine ability to bring magic to the company.
Through their multiple readings of The Secret.
Yep.
Thinking good thoughts will, you know, produce magical results.
They were going to supercharge the organization. And
yeah,
we all like, the narrative is great. And, but unfortunately, I can count on a hand, maybe we say Steve Jobs was one of those guys.
Maybe.
And then it starts going, Jack Welch was one of them at GE, but
he was kind of a dick though.
Yeah. So now,
if you'll excuse the French.
So now, I'm sure there are a lot of organizations that are led by people who are quite talented and have great leadership, but you read, just the general, business type stuff. What other organizations have really been amazingly transformed by the people at the top of their organization? I mean, they're out there, but.
Yeah, you're right. And the ship captain isn't always steering the ship, right? I mean, it's.
Right. So there's two things here. One is, our financial structures for organizations been set up so the people at the very top get hugely rewarded with the thought that they're able to do this. Their presence is the thing that is changing the organization, and they deserve the money that they get at the top of it. But it also puts a huge burden on them. It's saying, okay, you've got to be responsible for the performance of every person all the way down through your organization. That your vision has to be inspiring enough, and your anticipation has to be accurate enough that this entire organization is going to just, steam ahead. And I think that is, it's like the person who, sorry, I was going to make a football analogy here, but the quarterback,
this one has promise.
Yeah. The quarterback always gets too much praise when the team wins, and always too much blame when the team loses. And I think it's the same way with the person at the top. If you think that leadership comes as this author talks about with a big L, you've got a person that sits at the top, and the leadership emanates from that one person.
So he's instead saying that his little L leadership, which is more on expertise and influence and the ability to get things done, and also at the same time inspire others, because you're getting things done and actually leading efforts from actual action, right? Instead of speeches, or instead of what do they call them? Corporate statements.
Mission statements.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. You're never gonna succeed in any substantial way by just making mission statements from an engineering perspective on up, right? Engineers can lead by getting things done, I think.
Right. Well, there's a book, and I think it's Managing Leadership. I think that's the name of the book, by Jim Straub. And I've read the book twice in the past year because I really liked the book. And he makes the case that this idea of the great big L leader at the top is a sort of misplaced myth. And that leadership really comes from the organization, from the people within the organization. And depending on what's going on, the leadership will come from different people. It's not one person. So if there's a delivery that has to be made late at night, it may be somebody on the shipping dock that is the leader. If something has to happen in sales, it may be a salesman that's the leader.
Closing that sale, right?
But the idea is that the leadership comes from the organization. And so great managers know how to manage the organization to enhance this leadership and encourage people to take the lead.
And reward them when they do, right?
And reward them when they do.
Right.
And he also makes the real interesting case of in battle, he was former military, so he uses military analogies, but that you need the people that aren't out in front. That is, if you've got a squad that's moving up on the enemy, somebody has to go, 10 or 20 feet ahead. But then it's just as important that the people that are behind come back up, so if the lead guy goes out 20 feet, then the other guys have to work their way up to come even with him. And then he can go another 20 feet and they come up even. So this whole bit of leadership, it has to be fostered with those who are not necessarily in front all the time, but their willingness to come up and support the people who are in front.
That's a good point. So what was that book again?
I think I've got it. It's Managing Leadership. If not, I'll find it around here and I'll make sure we've got it right in the show notes.
Okay, cool.
It's not a recent book. I had to buy it used because I'm not even sure it's currently in print, but I really didn't like the book.
Well, we should move on to the next one because we're running down on time here.
Okay.
So number 8, he says, is street smarts. And the way I am reading his definition of street smarts is, I would probably call this politics.
Yeah, if you have this sense of savvy,
right.
Great. If you don't have it, how the heck do you get it?
Well, and I think even more than having the savvy, he says is it's not just, ignoring politics completely or playing the political game all day long. It's, knowing when to step into that and when to kind of shake that mud off your shoe kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I would agree with this as well. I think this is a good one for engineers as well, because no one wants an engineer that's playing that playing politics all the time. They, at some point you have to actually, do the design, get stuff done. But
right.
At other times you need to know that, fighting a small political battle or, giving up on a decision to someone else, is a necessary thing because it's just part of the lubrication that makes large organizations made of human beings run, right? That's mm-hmm. what it all comes down to in office politics is human beings and egos and everything else.
So I had a boss once that talked about how he enjoyed the challenge of sort of playing chess with the VP. This was the VP of engineering, but he enjoyed playing sort of the chess of organizational politics with the guy who was VP of another division. Mm. And it kind of struck me as, well, that's all well and good, but what about the rest of us that are further down? Does that not bother you at all? What the hoops you're making us jump through so that you can play this game of chess with your competitor?
Everybody loves being the chess master. No one wants to be the pawn, right?
Yeah, yeah. It's certainly a balance, like so many things in life. You need a certain amount of this political savvy to get ahead, but too much of it can be detrimental.
Everyone can always be out-politicked, right? And
right.
Yeah, I think it always can. It not always. It can lead to bad things, right? If you're trying to get ahead by making others look bad, or you're trying to get ahead by making yourself look super good, you're probably going to step on some toes in the process. So I think it's good to, you said, have balance.
But you're going to step on somewhere along the way, you're going to step on toes anyhow. Trying to make everybody happy is a sure way to make nobody happy.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So you got to at some point say, this I'm going to do because I believe this is right, and go do it.
Mm. Ethics episode.
Oh, yeah, we did cover that, didn't we?
That's right, yes. That's a good one. That's a good example of that, right? And kind of sticking to your guns and knowing when you're not going to go spend another $500,000 to, make more prototypes so that you can, you know, appease other people's interests. No, at some certain point, you need to just go get it done and start making stuff and take a risk and put it out there. So I agree with that. That's a good point.
Yeah, and even if it doesn't, if you're doing it because you think it's the right thing to do, then even if it doesn't mean that you move up in this particular organization, it probably means that you're being more true to your interests, and it's probably going to make you more employable in some other company.
So, speaking of being employable in general,
yeah,
let's get to number 9.
Let's do that.
Which is about show and tell. And so I'm not sure if this is the most important of the, because this is
the least important.
Or the least important.
We don't know.
Right. But I like the contrast on this one. So show and tell, right? The average performer, as the author states it, thinks that show and tell means getting noticed as much as possible, basically by, you know, always volunteering to do the presentations, always showing off their work, you know, talking about how great they are. But they're saying that the star performer knows when and where to actually show these things off, and when and where to give credit to other people, because, you know, they were doing the work. You know, they sometimes you might be the leader of a project, but if I was the leader of a project, but Jeff is the main mechanical designer on something, I could very easily take credit for all that work. And I think that's what the point they were making, that the average performer would say. Well, but no, sometimes it's not sometimes, I think all the time, but it's more important to know that, you know, like, giving credit to others is an important thing, and especially when it's due, and showing off your own credit in ways that are either subtle or, you know, at the right time.
Yeah. And I think that it sort of relates to, if you're going out in business for yourself, you have to have sort of a message that you're trying to deliver, a brand. Brand's not the right word, but a persona that people see you as. So if you want to be the, you know, the whiz-bang, you know, web designer, then you want to be seen that. But even that's not enough. You want to be the web designer who works with small machine shops, or the analog engineer who works with, you know,
medical devices or something.
Medical devices. Yeah. So the key in, you know, in marketing, it's the idea of getting, developing a niche or niche, depending on which part of the country you come from, and focusing and tailoring your message so that people continue to perceive you as that.
Well, and even more than that, though, I think in the context of this show and tell, right?
Yeah.
There's something to be said about coming out and saying, well, you know, I'm the best web designer, and I've designed something for, you know, machinist A, B, and C.
Right.
But there's something much more powerful about saying, yeah, I've done work for machinist A, and then doing good enough work so that machinist B, C, and D are telling other people about your work. That's the really powerful thing in terms of, you know, if you are looking to actually leverage your, you know, your past work in order to get future work or promotion. It's not always about coming out front and saying, I'm so awesome. It's coming out and doing good work, and then hopefully it's good enough that other people want to talk about you, because...
Right. I guess the point I was trying to make is that if you came out and said, hey, I want to show you my solid modeling work, and then a month later, oh, look at this analog work I did. And then a month later, hey, I did this digital design. Mm-hmm. And then a month later, hey, I tried my hand at marketing. The problem is... the higher ups are going to look and go, he doesn't have a clue what he's doing. So this is what I'm taking from this show and tell bit, is that if you're going to do it, that, you know, average performers show what they're doing, but the star performers think of the message they're trying to deliver and then tailor their show and tell sessions to deliver that, so that you're perceived as, hey, I'm the best in the company at, you know, analog design for this customer, or what, right. You know, whatever it is you're trying. Now, the problem is, when you're young and in an organization, you don't know what the heck you're good at, and you don't know what you want to do. It's a little hard to tailor that. I guess I would say, take a try at it, you know, figure out what you think you want to be good at it, and then, you know, start acting as though you are.
And the other point that the author makes here too, which I think is important as well, is say you're trying to move laterally within an organization, right? You enjoy mechanical design, but now you want to move into industrial design because you want to do more of the conceptual and the artistic work, mm-hmm. right? It's not necessarily just showing off that, you know, you've done conceptual designs before and you've done sketches and renderings and everything. It's also who you're showing them to, right? So if you want to move into the industrial design group, you could be blasting out this to everyone in the organization that, oh, look at these industrial designs I've done. What do you think of them? If you're showing that to the analog designer, he doesn't give a crap.
Right.
You know, or if you're showing your manager, he doesn't give a crap because, well, why aren't you working on mechanical right. designs? So your audience there is important as well. Maybe you want to be working for the, you know, the industrial design group. So you need to show it at the right moments, you know, for the right people.
Right.
You know, you need to actually show your value to the task at hand.
So sort of sum it up, you know your audience and shape your message to it.
Yeah. Just like we were talking about earlier. That's good. So that's kind of all nine. We kind of covered them all, huh?
Yeah, we did. So are you ready to go become a star engineer? You think you got everything, all the tools you need in your toolbox?
You know, that's the thing. No, this isn't it. I mean, come on. You know, in reading the Amazon reviews of the book, right, we were reading the article here. One of the reviews that was not a 5-star review, it said, it all boils down to this. Take initiative, network, and broaden your perspective. And I think that's right. I mean, like, it is true. I mean, Mr. Kelly here is putting out some good examples, I think. And I think they can be abstracted out. They are abstracted out from not just engineering, but, you know, graphic design or marketing or whatever other groups that, you know, people might be working in. For all our listeners that happen to be, you know, marketers that are listening. How you doing? but, you know, it's nice. It is nice to have a couple more discrete steps of things to watch out for. So, you know, we can recount those in the show notes and hopefully people do take them to heart. I mean, or maybe they won't. Maybe they don't care about advancing. And, you know, it depends on where people are in their life and where they are in an organization. You know, if you're at a small company, sometimes there isn't anywhere to go. So, yeah. And that's okay too. You know, like there are some benefits to, you know, staying in the same job in terms of expertise and comfort, lifestyle, and everything else. So,
well, and you're more likely, I think, to the longer you stay with the organization, you know its history, you know its culture, the more likely you're able to do well. I saw an article in the Harvard Biz. I keep saying Harvard Biz because that's their Twitter tag, and I forget that it's Harvard Business Review.
Right.
But they had a blog article about how CEOs didn't tend to do well once they moved outside of their own organization. So if they grew up with Company A, developed in Company A, they may do well in running Company A, but that talent disappeared when they moved them over into Company B.
Because you lose all those interpersonal relationships that often contributed to success in the first
place.
Yeah,
and your sense
right?
of the culture and how the you know, what's important. And I think that's true for engineers as well. I think it's good to see what happens in other companies, and I'm certainly, you know, not opposed to people moving around somewhat in their career. But you do gain something by being with an organization for a long time where you know what the company's all about.
Right, and these days, I mean, I think that is an increasingly rare thing. I mean, I'm not necessarily promoting it because I haven't stayed at a company for more than, you know, three or four years. And, but that I think in terms of younger engineers, I think that those that do stick around, you know, if they can stick around with, you know, the way that workplaces are these days, there are benefits in that because I think that in certain regards, if you move around like that, they're rewarded depending on the company culture as well. But
just, you don't want to get so attached to the idea of I will be here forever. Because you never know when the company's going to get sold or spun off or, you know, something, you know, horrendous is going to happen to the pipeline. So you don't want to be, while it's good to stay with the company, you don't want to be so attached to it that you ignore the prospect of other opportunities.
Well, we should leave it at that. We should get on to other opportunities that we have, like sleeping.
Yes, those would be good, wouldn't they?
Eating and everything else, right? All right. Well, I enjoyed this week.
It was great.
I think hopefully our listeners found it useful.
Right, and you know, if you find that these tips, these ideas lead you to being a star engineer, well, we'd love to hear from you and tell us about your story.
Yeah, and once again, the book is Robert E. Kelly, the How to Be a Star at Work, So if people are interested in that as well, we'll link all that in the show
notes. Absolutely.
Until then, you can subscribe to us on iTunes, and you can find us on Twitter and anywhere else. I think that's it.
That's enough.
That's more than enough. All right, Jeff, we'll see you next time.
All right, take care.
The Engineering Commons is produced by Analog Life, LLC, and Engineering Revision, in association with Engineering.com. Theme music by Paul Stevenson. For more info, visit theengineeringcommons.com.